Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm really wanting is for you to get your exercise information from the research experts rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Professor Shona Holson from Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, Australia. She's an expert on sleep, recovery, and fatigue in athletes. So we talked about how much sleep do athletes have and how much sleep do athletes need, the effect of insufficient sleep on exercise performance, and also the effect of sleep on recovery and fatigue. She said that sleep is sort of the cornerstone. You need to have sufficient sleep. You need to have good nutrition, etc. And then the other things that maybe just are icing on the cake. So things like ice baths, contrast baths, compression garments may have some small effects, but the most important thing is to get your sleep and your nutrition in order. With recovery, we talked about physical recovery, but also mental, so mental fatigue, etc. I found it really interesting. I think you will too, so stick around. Also, if you can do me a favor, please like, subscribe, comment, etc., because the algorithm tends to like that, so it tends to pop up more when people do searches, etc. And you will note that I have timestamps below, so if you're on YouTube, you can actually click on the times and it'll take you straight to that point. And then on other programs like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, etc., you can see the timestamps, but you just sort of take note of what's taking place at that time. But I would, of course, prefer for you to watch the whole thing because then you'll get a better understanding of the whole area. So anyway, stick around. And I'm sure you'll enjoy this one. Hi, Shona. How are you? Welcome to Inside Exercise.
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for having me on.
No, my pleasure. Okay, so we're going to be talking about sleep, recovery, fatigue, and athletes and sports in particular. But all I'd like to do at the start is just sort of ask about you. So how did you get into sports, sort of exercise research? Were you a sports person to start with, or did you get into science and think, oh, I might start looking at sports?
Yeah, good question. I was very interested in science, but also was probably your typical sports scientist that liked sport to participate in, but wasn't quite good enough, right? So got to combine my love of exercise and science in the one thing. So.
Okay, so where did you start off, and why don't you just tell people a little bit about where you are now?
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate course at QUT in Brisbane and did my PhD through there as well as Birmingham University in the UK, and then headed straight out to the Australian Institute of Sport. So I worked there as the head of recovery for nearly 16 years. Then in 2018, transitioned across to academia and have been at ACU since then.
Right. Okay. So what I would like to do also is just clarify in people's heads, like we did before we started, you know, what are we talking about? So sleep's easy. I think we all understand sleep. But then with recovery and fatigue, so, you know, are we talking about recovery from each bout or more sort of chronic? And then fatigue, I guess we're not talking about, you know, I had Hakim Westenblad on talking about, you know, what's causing fatigue in your muscles during exercise, calcium release and all this sort of stuff. I guess we're talking about more sort of ongoing. Do you want to just sort of explain what you're talking about there with that?
Yeah, so I guess my approach to recovery and where we've done most of the research has initially been from a real practical perspective. So, you know, working with athletes, what can they do from a day-to-day basis to either train better next time they train or to perform better if they're in a performance setting? So from a recovery perspective, we've looked at a lot of like physical recovery strategies like water immersion and ice baths and different types of compression and those sorts of things. So we've looked at really physical recovery strategies and how to sort of match that to the fatigue that's induced. So we have explored a little bit around different types of exercise and what sorts of recovery strategies might be best, but then always thinking of sleep as like the best recovery strategy that we have, and so, you know, sleep and nutrition being really the foundations of those recovery strategies for exercise for athletes post exercise.
Okay, so we won't be talking so much about the nutrition. So an obvious thing people think about, okay, after exercise, how am I going to recover for the next bout? Maybe high carbohydrate diets and, you know, make sure I'm hydrated. We won't be talking about those things. It's more like we're kind of assuming people are doing that. Is that right? And then it's sort of icy on the cake, maybe.
Yeah, and I guess we, you know, when the work that we've done, especially when I was at the Institute of Sport, you know, we had the nutrition department, we had Louise Burke, right, you know, leading the way. And so there was, you know, we've sort of seen that there's a lot of good nutrition research from a recovery perspective done over the years. And so knowing that nutrition is absolutely one of the foundations and fundamental aspects of recovery, the approach that we looked at was some of the more physical and applied strategies mm-hmm. that athletes could use day to day.
Right. So if we start off thinking about sleep, as you said, that's sort of the cornerstone. And if you, I guess if you're not sleeping enough, the rest of it maybe not be as much as important. Can we just think about how much sleep do people need? Because I know if we think about, if you're not a sports person, they tend to talk about this inverted U or whatever, mm-hmm. that, you know, if you mm-hmm. don't have enough sleep, and then even if you have too much, and like 7 hours is sort of like the cutoff. I guess it depends on the sport. It depends. So why don't you tell us, how much do people actually need? Do they need more if they're a sports person than a non-sports person, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think what we think with athletes, we don't know, but we think that because, you know, sleep really serves to repair the body and the brain from the previous day, right? And so we think that athletes probably need more physical recovery. So probably needing, you know, sleep probably helps in that space in terms of getting more physical recovery. But in terms of what an athlete needs, I think, yes, an athlete probably needs more than someone who's not exercising as much. But then within athletes, it's highly variable. And so we do know now there's quite a strong genetic component to sleep. And, you know, you see it sometimes with athletes and you see some are quite short duration, but their quality is really good. Or there's other times where you see people, they sleep long, but they probably need to. Because their quality is quite poor. And so what we try to do is, you know, encourage athletes to sort of think about what the amount of sleep they need to feel like they function best and to aim for that amount. And for one athlete, it might be 7. For another, it might be 9 to 10. You may have seen we published a paper a couple of years ago, and the title was "How Much Sleep Does an Elite Athlete Need?" And what we did was we just asked them, you know, how much sleep do you feel like you need to be able to, you know, to feel refreshed and to do what you need to do? And then we actually measured the sleep in these athletes and found that on average, athletes were getting about 95 minutes less sleep per night than they felt they actually needed. So I think there's the amount that people need, and then there's the amount that people get. And partly, you know, contributed, you know, by the fact that there's lots of things that can get in the way of someone's sleep. Plenty of things that we can maybe talk about at some point, but there's lots of things that can get in the way.
So how do I mean, it seems sort of obvious. You just think, oh yeah, I feel tired. So, and if I have this much sleep, I don't feel tired. So this is how much I need. But is there a way of like measuring that? Like, is there a way of actually measuring like, oh, you're getting too much, not enough, or is it just obviously you're falling asleep while you're working, or you can't get to sleep because you're not tired?
Yeah, we tend to get them to think about three key questions. We tend to ask how you feel within an hour of waking up. So you should feel relatively, no one feels perfect as soon as they wake up, right? But within an hour, you should feel pretty good. You should be able to get through the day without needing a nap. So you should be able to, you know, get through to your normal bedtime. And then you should fall asleep in a reasonable amount of time. So at night. So if you put your head on the pillow and you're gone in 0 minutes, you're completely asleep, it's probably a sign that you're a little sleep deprived.
Now, what do you remember what the numbers were? So how many hours do they feel like they need, and how many hours do they get?
Yeah. Well,
it's obviously whatever you said, 75 minutes less. Yeah, and then do you know how that compares to if you asked a non-athlete? Again, it's so variable because some athletes, you know, it's so different how much energy they're going through, how much, I don't know, mental focus they have, whatever that they need for their sport. Do you know, is there like a difference? So if you ask someone who's a non-athlete, they say 7 hours. You ask an athlete, they say 8.5.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything that's looked at the difference between elite athletes and non-athletes. We do see in general, though, that athletes sleep less in terms of duration and quality than the general population. So they actually get less. Yes, even though really? we've shown that in our athletes, and the UK, some groups from the UK have shown something similar as well. So you would think that with the requirement for more sleep being there for an athlete, that they'd get more. And, you know, you see athletes tired all the time, right? And the question is, are they fatigued from training? Are they fatigued from not sleeping enough? But generally, athletes could get more sleep. And we're starting to understand now some of the reasons why athletes might find it challenging to get the sleep that they need.
Wow. So they actually sleep less. Again, I've got the 7 hours in my head at one stage, because I always thought it'd be eight for some reason. I think they said seven was sort of like, you know, and then less was not good. And then if you have like 10 or whatever, that's not necessarily good either. Mm-hmm. But whatever it is, they're actually sleeping less than that, even though they're doing all this extra demands mentally and physically in some ways.
Yeah, sleeping less than the general population. And we know the general population don't sleep well either. So, athletes, the data that's out there suggests that they're actually sleeping less.
Okay. But they tend to do well, obviously. So it's weird.
Yeah.
I wonder if we've somehow got it back to front. You know what I mean? Like, just intuitively. I wonder if there's somehow, this is kind of weird, but, you know, because how does it work out that way? You know what I mean? Like, I know, okay, you'll say they're stressed and they can't sleep well, maybe they're traveling or whatever. But if they end up being so good and they don't sleep very much, I wonder if somehow exercise is sort of having some sort of brain, you know, calming effect or some really weird thing.
I would think that based on the sleep extension work that's been done in athletes, that if they got more, they'd be better.
That was the next question. Yeah.
So the data suggests that when I look at these sleep extension studies in athletes where they get an extra hour and a half, I think they're just bringing them back to normal, right? So they're not really true sleep extension. Well, they are sleep extension because they're the athletes are getting more sleep than they were. But in reality, they're probably being just more like, more like the general population, or more like they should be getting.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you before I said the last strange bit. I was going to say, if you get them to sleep a bit longer, do they do better? So they do better performance-wise, or?
Yeah, so and there's not much work in this space. Most of the research is done on sleep deprivation. So you look at all the effects, you know, the negative effects of sleep deprivation, and we've seen that quite consistently. The thing that we don't have as much research on, but the research that is there suggests that, yes, if athletes get more sleep, so the sleep is extended over a reasonable amount of time, like you probably need at least 5 days, then you will see performance effects, mood effects, effects on cognitive function. It's quite consistent in those small number of studies that have done it.
Okay, well, it makes sense, right? I was just trying to think of it. If it was so widespread, you wonder if it's somehow, you know, like designed that way. But if you're saying that when you do longer, they do better, then that makes sense.
Yeah.
What about different? Because
The only thing I was going to say is we're just talking, I guess, about nighttime sleep. Athletes nap. They nap a lot. They've got less. If you look at over a 24-hour period, athletes are probably getting the same, if not more, sleep than some people because they need to top up with their naps during the day. Yeah. So we've done a bit of work as well. So, yeah.
I thought the whole time we were talking about total sleep. Okay. So let's step back a little bit. So if we're talking about the sleep over the whole day, athletes aren't sleeping less than
we think that's probably closer to the general population. If you just most of the studies though, and the challenge is it's really hard to measure naps accurately. Really hard.
Mm-hmm.
What we do see is that somewhere between 20 to 90 minutes during the day is about right. To top up. So it really depends on like how sleep deprived you are will have a relationship to how much sleep you will need during your nap. If you look at nighttime sleep in athletes, they tend to get less, and that's because we get them up early for training and all those kinds of things. And the reason that they have to nap is because their sleep during the night is shorter. But a lot of athletes during the day can't nap, so that makes it a challenge.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. The whole time we were talking, I was thinking total sleep. So you think total, just to summarize, are you thinking generally across the whole day? Because I know obviously it's important if it's night during the day, right?
Yeah.
If we say they're sleeping less, I'm assuming during the whole day. They sleep about the same, probably on average. but not more. And you'd think that they would probably sleep more.
Yeah, so, I would say it wouldn't be more. Yeah, it wouldn't be more than the general population, but we really don't have good napping data in the general population in athletes. We think athletes are doing it just to top up because they're absolutely not getting enough.
Yeah. Okay. And then when we talk about athletes, again, it's a broad topic. So what about if it's endurance versus strength versus, because I obviously a lot, and I know you've done research on this, is training load, effective training load, and then getting fatigued if training load's too high, et cetera. Does training load physically or even mentally affect how much sleep someone needs? So, if you're training like crazy, but you don't have to, like if you're a cyclist cycling 6 hours a day, but it's just turning the pedals and there isn't I don't want to put down cyclists, trust me. It's the main thing I do nowadays. You don't have to think about it. But if it's something where it's really technical, and you've got to think and you're a decathlete and you've got 10 different events to think about do you know if that affects how much sleep they need? The sort of the physical load, the mental load?
Yeah, we think it does. And so when we have done some work looking at mental recovery and mental fatigue, and that mental fatigue seems to be really closely related to sleep. So there definitely seems to be some strong relationship there. But a lot of the work, so if you look at sleep over a night, and you look at architecture and you look at REM sleep and you look at non-REM sleep, there's the general theory is that they serve different functions, and that depending on where you are in sleep, you're prioritizing brain restoration or you're recovering, physically. And so if you just really need a big lot of physical recovery, you might be, getting a little bit more deep sleep, because that's what your body's prioritizing. Or if you really need to, repair the cognitive, your brain from a lot of cognitive fatigue, then you may have a different stage of sleep. You might get a little bit more REM to try and recover your brain sleep. But what we do know is that there's been a couple of studies done. We've been involved in these as well. If you're training really hard, like you're in the almost overreaching kind of state, like you're really doing intensified training, you're quite likely to have disturbed sleep. Again, doesn't make that sense, in terms of what you actually need, but it's almost like a fight or flight kind of response where the body's not getting the sleep and the brain is not getting the sleep that it's required because you've got these super high stressful training loads.
Okay, and then they sleep less.
Sleep less.
It just less, or is it also the, like you said, the architecture, the REM versus?
Yeah, it seems to be more disturbed, so less quality sleep with really high training loads.
Okay. And just to clarify, so when you say the quality, because I'm not too good on the REM versus the deep and whatever, when you talk about quality of sleep, so just say same person sleeping 7 hours and then the next day they sleep 7 hours, but the quality is not as good. What does that actually mean?
I would say the simplest way to explain that is they're getting the higher quality sleep someone has, the less lighter sleep that they're having. So they're in those less light, because you've got multiple stages of sleep, and there's some that are considered really light, and they're not as restorative for the body or for the brain. So you're probably getting more light sleep. You're probably waking up a little bit more, and so you probably just generally have more disturbed sleep when you've got lighter or lower quality.
And you're saying the REM tends to be more sort of brain recovery, and the deeper sleep is more the physical. Is that right?
It's quite a generalization, but that's really the way that that sleep is viewed at the moment.
Okay. And do you find that the people that need the more, I'm getting a bit nitty gritty, but I'm just finding it interesting. Do we find the people that need more mental, activities related to the exercise, do they tend to have more the sort of the REM, and the people that really just grinding away for hours and hours and hours, they tend to have more of the deep? Is that too simple?
We don't know. And one of the challenges is because measuring brain activity during sleep is not easy. So previously, the only way to do it is to put people in a sleep laboratory, which is really expensive and artificial and can't get athletes in there, right? Now we're starting to have more sort of portable equipment that can be done at home, like single channel EEGs. So now we're able to do more home environment type studies, which opens us up to be able to explore these kinds of measures in elite athletes, which it's almost impossible to get an elite athlete in a sleep lab for a few nights where they, they're not allowed out. We will have answers to those questions as we get more sort of applied technology that athletes can use in home or when they're training or in training camps and those kinds of things.
Okay. And when we talk about sleep affecting performance, I guess we haven't really talked specifically about performance. So if you have one bad night, because I remember when I was a distance runner, it was almost like normal just to have a crappy night's sleep before a big race. And I didn't feel like it affected me, just one night. So when you're talking about sleep and exercise performance, is it usually like, is it one night is not a problem, but if it's, do you know that? Is like one night a problem? Because it didn't seem to be. But if you had a few nights in a row, you'd be like, crap, I don't feel like running.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. So the data seems to suggest somewhere between 3 to 5 days as a minimum of reduced sleep, so deprived sleep. So we're talking probably 2 or 3 hours less than you'd get normally between 3 to 5 days, and you'll start to see a performance effect. But the interesting thing is the science shows that if the physiology doesn't change, right, it's not like all of a sudden your VO2 max just drops ridiculously. It's your perception of effort raises. So everything, and we all know what it feels like, right? Everything feels hard and uncomfortable, and that tends to be, especially when you're in a lab, right, and you're trying to get people to go as hard as they can when they're sleep deprived. It's all around perception of effort that we think is the real key to why people's performances will drop. But yes, it's a balance when I'm talking to athletes. It's like we want you to pay attention to your sleep, and we want you to be a good, consistent sleeper as often as you can. But if it's the night before an Olympic final and you get a bad night in the village, which you probably will, you're going to be fine. 20 years of training doesn't disappear. You might feel a bit ordinary, but you get to the start line, you can't tell me that your adrenaline and probably caffeine is not going to solve some of your perception of effort issues.
Exactly. So the motivation will be so high. I saw you had a paper, first author, 2022, so I think it ties into what we're talking about here: sleep regularity and predictors of sleep efficiency and sleep duration in elite team sport athletes. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what you're doing with that one?
So there's a real interest in non-athletes. It's been in the sleep world for a little while about how important consistency of sleep is. Bedtime, wake time, as consistent as possible. We know that shift workers have really, poor sleep because of the lack of consistency. And so we had this opportunity to, like during COVID, when you can't actually test real people, so you go, I've got massive amounts of sleep data from really good athletes. How about we just try and explore it and see what we can find? So what we did, and to explore this idea about regularity of sleep. And so essentially what we found is those athletes who were more regular, so consistency in bed and wake time, had better quality of sleep. So they didn't sleep longer, but their quality of sleep was better. And interestingly, and just in the last couple of months, there's been some big papers published out of Monash using the UK Biobank data on sleep. And they're showing that, again, it's probably more important to be consistent in your sleep rather than duration. So consistency is probably more important. And often for a lot of people, consistency you can kind of control. Like maybe you have to get up early all the time, but you can potentially control your consistency. And a lot of athletes might not have a whole lot of control over the actual duration that they're able to get. So being consistent now, and I think I look at, I've analyzed so many athletes' sleep over the years, and you get the diary and you get the sleep watch. And sometimes I think I just need to look at the diary and I can look at their bed and wake times. And I got a pretty good idea of how messy their sleep is going to be based on how consistent they are or not.
That's interesting. So it comes down to sort of circadian rhythm, not messing around with your timing.
Yeah, I just explain it to athletes. Like, we need to, the body likes to know, what it's going to expect. Like, and the expectation is, if you're bed at 10 and awake at 7, you want to do that regularly. And I often say to athletes, it's not, if you're going to bed at 10 p.m. one night and then 1 a.m. in the morning, the next, like, that's no different, technically speaking, to like traveling across to Perth, where we've got a 3-hour time zone change, right? Mm. So why would you do that? I mean, it is a little bit different when you look at jet lag and circadian rhythms, but why would you mess up your consistency if you don't have to? And some athletes have to, like you look at football players playing night matches, or, you know, you can't, if you're an NBA player, you know, your schedule is in all over the place. But for many, you know, regular exercises, you can have, you know, some reasonable control over your consistency. And I think that's one of the things that the message that hasn't quite got across in the sleep world yet is how important consistency is.
And I'm assuming you controlled for, because naturally, if you go to bed normally at 10 and get up at 7, for example, actually, that's pretty nice. It's 9 hours.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Or just say if you go to bed at 11 and get up at 7, mm-hmm. it's probably more likely, it's 8 hours. And then you say they go to bed at 1. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you control for the fact that it's not that they're getting up at 7. So it wasn't just that they were sleeping less. Even if they have the same amount of sleep, going to bed at different times messes things up. Is that right?
Yes, yes, it does. Yeah. And the thing that we do see, though, is most people have more control over their bedtime than their wake time, especially if you're an athlete and you've got to be at a, you know, you've got to be training at a certain time. Mm-hmm. So what people mess up is their bedtime. And mm-hmm. so that's why we encourage people to, because normally if you go to bed at 1 a.m. and that's like 3 hours later than you'd normally sleep, you normally wouldn't get that extra 3 hours.
Exactly. So that's why I was wondering if you, you know, control for that, because how do you do that? But you did. So maybe they did, instead of 11 till 7, they'd do 1 till 7 and then have a nap later or something.
Yeah.
You know, and so it ends up the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it doesn't, you know, people always say, you know, that old adage is it, you know, are the hours after midnight more important than the hours before midnight? And that's not really the case. The issue is that if you go to bed after midnight, you're likely just not to get the duration of sleep that you need, because we all have life and we all have things we need to do. Or, you know, in Australia mm-hmm. at the moment, the sun's up pretty early. So you just naturally get up, or you've got things to do, or you're used to getting up at a certain time. And so going to bed later just means you just truncate your sleep.
All right. But even if you do sleep the same, things won't be as good.
Yeah, if you're consistently doing this, even if it's the same mm-hmm. duration. Yep.
I always think, because it's not that long ago, you know, in evolutionary terms, since we were like cave people, can't go cavemen anymore, or even just we didn't have light, right? So obviously mm-hmm. It would get dark and you'd go to bed. It would mm-hmm. get light and you'd wake up, mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and that's just sort of normal. But now we've got all this, you know, blue light and all these lights and things, and we have the option of staying up. You wouldn't be staying up to 1 a.m. if you didn't have any light.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's where, you know, some of the research is really interesting, because they're looking at split sleep, which is, I think, what used to happen, you know, back when, you know, we didn't have artificial light, because it'd get dark, so you'd go to bed, but then you'd wake up in the middle of the night, and then you'd go back again to sleep, because you've gone to bed so early because the sun's gone down, right? So that's where that kind of split sleep sort of came from. But then also we see, you know, big differences depending on, you know, summer and winter and kind of where you are in the world.
I was thinking, because we're in Denmark here, and my fourth visit, we always come for summer. So I feel a bit bad actually, because I was saying to my collaborator yesterday, we sort of, you know, leave the sinking ship, because we come, you know, when it's nice, and when it's getting dark and kind of crappy, we take off. But if we, you know, if you love Copenhagen so much, why don't you come in winter? But yeah, so literally the difference, it gets in winter, it's like 4 hours a night. So you can't even say, oh, you go to bed when it's dark and get up when it's light, because that would be, you know, it's 4 hours at one end and it's 15 hours at the other. So, yeah. Okay. So just again, to sleep and performance, do we know how, so you said you need 3 or 4 days. Again, I keep thinking we're saying athletes. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference? Maybe you don't really know that, you know, 3 or 4 hours, 3 or 4 days of not sleeping enough, how much does it actually affect performance? And does it affect things where you need to sort of concentrate or whatever more than things where you just have to grind it out? Do you know that?
Yeah, it does. That does seem to be the case. But the thing that seems to be a little bit more important than that is the duration of the task, right? So if you ask someone to do a counter movement jump and you just ask them to do, you know, a one-off max jump, or, you know, even a 30-second, you know, Wingate test or something really short, often it's okay, you know, people can cope with that. ask them to do, you know, a 1 hour time trial or a team sport where they've, you know, obviously got to interact with other teammates and there's a lot more cognitive function, that's where you start to see the effects. So you need the kind of longer duration to be able to have the fatigue sort of show itself.
Okay, that makes sense. Now you had this one, I've written here somewhere on my notes, sleep or swim, early morning training severely restricts the amount of sleep. So I guess we touched on that. But it just reminds me, a couple of times I've seen on Twitter people saying, should I miss my exercise tomorrow if I can't sleep 4 hours? Or should I do the, I can only sleep 4 hours. Or should I do the exercise? You know, and then people say, people have strong views. Oh, no, you've got to do the exercise. Someone else said, no, you've got to do the sleep. I mean, I don't know. And I guess it depends. But do you have like if someone says, I'm only going to have 4 hours tonight, should I exercise tomorrow or take the day off? You know, in terms of recovery, so we're heading towards recovery, fatigue. Yeah. Is there an easy answer to that?
Yeah, I don't, and this is just me, this is things that I think, I don't know if there's any data to support my theory here, but I think if you're getting less than 6 hours of sleep in the night, then, you know, that's a concern. And I'd be prioritizing sleep if I'm at risk of getting less than 6 hours. And the hope is that you're not getting less than 6 hours all the time, right? So my thought would be that, because, I mean, sleep, we know how valuable exercise is, right? 100%. But we also know a lot of data how important sleep is for overall health, but not just for that, but for functioning the next day, for our reaction time, for our ability to be efficient at work, to not have injuries in terms of accidents and, you know, the data is so strong that when we see when daylight saving shifts and it's only 1 hour less of sleep, the number of accidents increase. Mm-hmm. So for me, if I'm not an elite athlete, you know, trying to get to the Paris Olympics, which I'm not, then I'd be prioritizing sleep, not every night, but as often as possible, I'd be making sure that I'm at least getting my 6 to 7 and then trying to squeeze some exercise in there as well. And I'm sure exercise people will completely disagree with me, but I think, you know, sleep is so foundational to our health that we shouldn't let it go too often.
So would you even go as far as if you're not training for the Paris Olympics? Well, I guess it's a question is if you are or not. And you literally knew you were going to have 4 hours sleep, or you had 4 hours sleep, and it was just a training session, you know, not a race, you know, because we already said you can have 4 hours and do great in the race. Mm-hmm. You've had 4 hours sleep. Would you say skip that session, or would you do it easy, or what would you do?
Yeah. If you'd already gotten the 4 hours and that's all you and you're awake and you're good to go, then I'd still do the exercise. It's just what I'm thinking is I wouldn't set my alarm to get up early to exercise if I've gone to bed one or two in the morning. But if you're awake, I'd still do the exercise. I'd still do the exercise during the day and maybe try and find, if you've got time to exercise, you might have time to do a little bit of a nap, have a little bit of a nap as well.
All right. And would you go, because I know I've done that. So if I've had really bad sleep and I just felt crappy, I think, you know what? I'm just going to have an easy day. You know, maybe I was planning on doing intervals or something. I'd say, make it an easy day today. Does that make, part of it just makes logical sense. You know, if your body's telling you know what, just have an easy day, or your brain is.
Yeah. It's
maybe
probably,
listen to it.
Yeah. It's probably that lack of motivation. But for me, if I'm really sleep deprived, like if I've been traveling and I'm jet lagged, I tend to do slightly, I feel like I can still push myself reasonably hard, but I'm careful about what I do. Like it might be on a stationary bike, right? Rather than, you know, doing box jumps off something where I might, you know, hurt myself. So I think, okay. I'm just going to play it safe and maybe that's me knowing the relationship between injury and sleep, but I know I'm more likely to probably fall over or do something silly. And it is harder to get, I think it's harder to get the motivation to turn up, but then I think once you turn up, you can push through, but being careful maybe about what you're actually doing if you've got a choice over what you're doing.
Another thing is, this might be just my weird thing, is when I have like 4 hours sleep or something, sometimes I actually feel a bit up. Have you seen that with people? Yeah. Like when they do sleep studies, I feel like a bit up, like kind of like, you know,
it's a bit of like
manic or something.
Yeah. So it's almost like a bit of euphoria. Yeah. Sometimes, and I find that actually when I'm also a bit jet lagged, I find I go through ups, highs and lows. And I think people do talk about that. It's probably just a way of the brain kind of going, you got to get through this. So trying to make you feel good.
Yeah, now I can't help thinking it was also when we're talking about early in the morning and people feeling tired and things. I don't actually drink tea or coffee. I'm a bit of a strange one. So I actually saw you had something on a meta-analysis on caffeine and sleep. So I wonder how much that sort of makes things hard to study because, you know, if these people are having caffeine, which is a stimulant, and they're probably having more if they're tired, do you control when you in your studies, do you try and I guess if you did control that, if you took away the caffeine when they normally drink it, then that's a problem as well. Like, how do you actually look at that?
This was a conversation we had about 12 months ago with a range of people because we're actually, so yes, the meta-analysis, we looked at existing studies that had looked at different doses and different timing of caffeine and then look and sleep. And so we did those calculations and we got some data and some cutoffs, but then we wanted to do the study ourselves, right? So we wanted to look at different doses and different timing of caffeine consumption on sleep. But the question is then, as exactly as you say, if you take the caffeine away, they're probably going to have a negative response, but you've got to control for it. So what we did was we chose people who were not really high caffeine intake people. We had them around between 100 and 300 milligrams a day. We gave them their habitual dose at the start in the morning so that they were just in capsule form. And then we gave them their caffeine, the actual intervention throughout the day. Because, yeah, it is a really... You get criticized either way. You know, if you give caffeine, you don't control it, or you do, or you take it away. It's a bit of a challenge. So we provided them with their habitual dose in the morning.
And I guess when people do have, you know, so you're doing a study, but I'm just thinking about just in real life. I guess when people do have less sleep and you're saying, well, it doesn't really affect their performance the next day or two, or, you know, if they have a couple of days, I guess they're having more caffeine.
Right? I would suggest they are. When I've looked at, again, athletes' sleep diaries, where we ask them to record a lot of things and record caffeine intake, you certainly see it. You know, it's post-travel. We did some work with an NFL team in the States, and they, you know, they're at the club really early and they go home really late because they're in small rooms, like looking at learning play and watching video in dark rooms. And there is some serious caffeine intake in those guys to get through the day. And of course, that's more than likely going to have ramifications for the nighttime sleep. And then they get to the club the next day and they've got to just keep pumping the caffeine in because it becomes a bit of a cycle of lots of caffeine, poor sleep, need more caffeine.
So do we know, this is a bit off to the side a bit, but do we know what time, because it seems to get early and early and earlier. Do you know... You know, just generally what time they're saying now, like it's like 2 PM or something.
Yeah, our meta-analysis was about 1:12 in the afternoon for a cutoff for 100 milligrams.
1:12?
Yeah, 1:12.
Oh, so you see people are going to be cranking it at 1 PM.
I know, we all talk about it at work, it's 1:12. That was just for a standard cup of coffee. If you looked at the data for some of these pre-workout supplements that have really high levels of caffeine in them, the cutoff time was before 10 o'clock in the morning, shouldn't be consumed, because that will have an effect on sleep at night. And we know athletes are using, you know, and general population are using pre-workouts in the afternoon. So
the pre-workouts are caffeine, a drink, I don't even know, to be honest, drinks that have caffeine or just other bits and pieces in them as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's probably a lot of bits and pieces, but a lot of the pre-workouts they have a focus on caffeine. And so the idea is that you've, you know, got this big stimulant hit, and you can, you know, really go hard in your afternoon training sessions. And some of them, you know, they think athletes go, oh, this is working really well for me, and they're training well. And then you look at the amount of caffeine, and you know, they have to have implications for the nighttime sleep. So it is that balance, and especially athletes that want to take caffeine for performance. Like if you're, you know, an elite athlete and you're performing at night, I'm like, you do what you got to do to play well, like, and to, you know, we want you to win. We want you to be good sleepers, but we really want you to win, right? And so if you need to take caffeine to feel like you are going to perform at your best, that's okay, but use it strategically. Don't use more than you actually really need. And if there's times that you don't need it, don't use it. But understand that if you're going to take it in the evening, there's a risk that you're going to have poor sleep that night.
Yeah, way back, and I did my master's with David Costell at Ball State in Indiana from 89 to 91. We actually did a study there, and it was interesting because I don't have tea, drink tea or coffee, right? But they looked at responders and non-responders, and I was actually a non-responder. So when they gave me a whack of caffeine, my blood pressure didn't go up, my heart rate didn't go up. But and then they had another guy who was just famous for like making these really strong, you know, this big macho thing every morning, who can make the strongest coffee. And his went through the roof. So, you know, his blood pressure and things. So even though he had a lot, so it's like you have responders and non-responders. But then at the same time, you can actually habituate to caffeine and you need more and more. So do you actually find that much in your studies that, I don't know, I don't actually know what I'm saying. So the people that like maybe are not really respond much, like they really crank it. And
What we have just looked at, and it's very fresh data. So I'm, you know, saying this with a grain of salt right now, because we haven't done the stats and done things on it. But with this caffeine study that one of the PhD students is at ACU is doing, we gave the different doses. We also looked at the genotyping for caffeine. We looked at metabolism and sensitivity. And because we, you know, probably at this point, because of the large variation, we're probably a bit underpowered to see anything in terms of the actual genotyping, but there definitely looks like if you're someone who's a slow metabolizer and you're sensitive to caffeine, you will have a bigger influence on your sleep than someone who metabolizes it fast and isn't sensitive to it. So we're starting to explore that space a little bit more. But then it's hard because, I mean, you probably know yourself. You can, people, you know, I think I always thought I was a relatively sensitive person to caffeine. And when I did my genotyping, I actually am. So maybe we don't need to genotype. Maybe people kind of know just off experience.
Okay. Well, it's funny. I sometimes think I'm all high and mighty. I don't have to line up, you know, for coffee and things to feel okay. But I crank a lot of chocolate. I'm a bad man for chocolate that has caffeine in it. Just talking about genotyping and things, it's actually good because the next thing on my list was here, Malcolm from Twitter. Is there a genetic, you know, it's genetic, is there a genetic link to how much sleep an individual needs? How much sleep is too much? Negatives of too much sleep. I guess we haven't really talked. So I guess there is a genetic link. I think you may have mentioned it earlier.
Yeah. So that's something that, you know, we can now, you know, look at circadian clock genes and all those kinds of things, you know, but we're starting to think, yes, there is a link. And it's interesting, you talk to people and you ask, you know, especially if someone's a sleepwalker or they've got a clinical sleep issue, you can almost be guaranteed it's somewhere in the family. But in terms of, you know, actual how much sleep you need, I think it will find out in time that that's the case, that it is definitely has a strong genetic link to your sleep. So and the question around too much sleep, I think that's a really interesting one, because a whole lot of there's been, you know, meta-analyses and assessments of, you know, sleeping too long, but it seems like that when people sleep too long, it's because they've got an underlying issue, as a health issue, like, or a mental health issue. And so the body's sort of, or the brain is asking for more sleep, right? So I find it very difficult to see how, if you're just a naturally long sleeper or you're just someone that naturally gets really good sleep, that that can be bad for your mortality. I just can't understand how that could be. But I think if you're someone who's sleeping long because that's in response to something that's negative, then yes, I can absolutely see how that could work.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about sleep, but now I'm just thinking about recovery and things like that. Now, you touched earlier on overtraining, overreaching. Do you want to just explain the differences between them and how they maybe affect recovery, et cetera?
That's such a good question. And you may or may not have seen it, but we recently published a paper where we actually tried to find the research that actually has been done on overtrained athletes. And we found zero papers that meet the definition, right? So it's a bit of a mess in terms of what we know scientifically, but we think that it's sort of on a continuum, right? So you've got training, you've got intensified training, you've got overreaching, and then you've got overtraining syndrome. And the difference between them is really, and the difference really between overreaching and overtraining is how long it takes you to recover. You're talking months, you know, from overtraining, you're talking weeks from overreaching, but it's just a theory. No one's ever, you know, and I understand why it hasn't been done. You can't keep pushing people until you move them from overreaching to overtraining, and, you know, maybe you've long damaged them sort of long term. So I understand why the studies haven't been done. But those differences between overreaching and overtraining, technically, from a definition, is how long it takes you to recover from the decline in performance that you need to see.
Well, that's interesting because, yeah, that for a while there was all the rage, these studies of so-called overtraining. I'm saying so-called based on what you just said. You know, and looking at immunoglobulins and the saliva and all this sort of stuff. It sounds like almost that quite a lot of those were probably overreaching, right? They'd say, oh, if your heart rate's elevated or even if your heart rate's depressed. But you're saying, so I just clarify what you're saying again, is that no one's really looked technically at overtraining because they didn't really know if it was overreaching or?
Yeah, so what we see in the, so there are definitely studies that I think are over, they've got overreached athletes and they call them overtraining. Because the problem is overtraining is the process as well as the outcome, right? So people get confused, like this is an overtraining study because I'm training people really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, you're doing an intensified training
that has by adding results. Extra.
Yes, and the result of that is either overreaching or overtraining. The studies on overtraining have really gotten athletes in and tried to look at diagnostic tests to prove that they're overtrained, right? So how do we, or to try and understand the mechanism. So you've got athletes that come in and they say, look, I meet the definition because my performance has been down for several months. My mood is disturbed and I can't recover, my performance is down, and it all ticks the boxes of the definition.
Mm-hmm.
But the classic question is, well, have you measured anything underlying in these people? Have they got, you know, something post-viral? Right. Have they got cardiac issues? So that's the big question, is we've never taken anyone through the full continuum to know, does overreaching actually end up resulting in overtraining? And is the time course of recovery really what differentiates the two states?
Right. And I saw in 2004, you had does overtraining exist? So obviously you've said you've been thinking about that more recently, and sorry if I haven't seen the paper since then. Do you think overtraining actually, it sounds like you do, but do you think overtraining actually exists? Because as you say, when you add a bunch of training on top of what people normally do, they normally get better. I remember when I was at, I'm kind of emeritus professor at Victoria University, but when I was there, you know, like on the payroll, David Bishop wanted to look at mitochondrial function. So David Bishop has been on the podcast and thought, okay, I'm going to overtrain people. Well, what did you call it?
When intensively you train them.
Intensively train people and then look at how it messes up their mitochondrial function.
Yeah.
And they just got better.
Yeah.
And I remember because it was this Cesare guy and it was just crazy. Mm-hmm. They were just throwing more and more training. They were getting to do HIIT twice a day. Yep. And they just got better. And said, okay, well, so we do it longer. And then I think they had to make them carbohydrate depleted. So give them low carbohydrate and train the crap out of them before they actually started to blow up.
Yes.
So,
You've nailed a couple of really important things there. It's really hard to, like, if you've got reasonably fit athletes, in our experience, they get better and better. If you've got not quite as fit people as your participants, then they can start to get fatigued. But generally speaking, most people just get better and better. You almost have to add. So I often think, is it overtraining or under recovery? So are they carbohydrate depleted? Is that what causing the issues? Are they not sleeping? I think if we've probably seen, when I was at the Institute, I think we probably saw one or two athletes that I would think, you are actually overtrained. You are the classical definition. We've had really good doctors come and explore every medical thing, and we think you're overtrained. One was a shift worker, one was incredibly stressed, life event stress, and was just not sleeping. Right. So I was like, maybe it's like lack of sleep and under recovery, because if you train well, the caveat to that is that when I was doing my intensified training overreaching studies in Birmingham, I was looking at cyclists, and there was another PhD student looking at runners, and all my cyclists finished and they did the whole protocol, the runners broke, right? They got injured. And the injuries were the way of saying, hang on, hold up, stop.
Exactly.
This is a little too much. So I think it does depend on
that's what injury. I was starting to think when you were saying that, because I thought what probably happens is you break down physically. You get injured before. But that's interesting. You're saying with cyclists, where you don't tend to get injured as much as runners, obviously, you're saying if you've got someone who's fit already, so a serious athlete, they can just keep adding on and adding on and adding on, and they will tend to not get overtrained. Is that right?
With sufficient recovery, I would.
Oh, sorry, carbohydrate and the sleep.
Yes, if they've got all the, and obviously there's a certain point, but you look at, you know, cyclists on training camps, like pro cyclists. I mean, they, and you look at the tour, like, you know, they can just push themselves to the extreme, but you've got to give periods of time. Like, you can't just keep doing that, you know, forever. You have to give periods of time for a taper, periods of time for some general recovery, you know, 2 to 3 weeks of pushing people, or even up to 4 or 5 weeks of pushing people really hard. I think as long as they've got the daily recovery embedded and they know there's an end in sight and it's not going to keep going forever and a day, then I think a lot of people will respond really well to that.
That's the thing, as you said, with the Tour de France, for example, it's 3 weeks. And if anything, they're stronger. Not all of them, you know, obviously some are just hanging on for dear life.
Yeah.
But, you know, often you'll see the winner, for example, will just split the final time trial or something, almost stronger than they were two weeks earlier, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
But again, you say it's probably a 3 week tour for a reason. If it was a 4 week tour, then maybe they'd start to fall apart.
For sure.
Okay. So with recovery, again, you talked about carbohydrate, which is important. Mm-hmm. Actually, when you said the carbohydrate with the runners versus the cyclists, it reminded me of the classic study by David Kostel. Again, he did carbohydrate. He looked at glycogen, so doing repeated biopsies over days of training. And cyclists versus runners, and the cyclists were able to resynthesize every day and just stay pretty normal, and the runners just sort of kept going down. And I think that's when they started thinking about the eccentric exercise, the muscle damage, and it affecting glycogen resynthesis. And we did a bunch of studies on that, so that's interesting. So yeah, it depends on the sport. And then just to summarize again, you were saying you might be able to just, if you're really fit to start with, go nuts for a few weeks. But that's assuming you've got the high carbohydrate, the fluids, the sleep, or doing all the right stuff.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, that's my general theory when it comes to, because I think people always worry if you're talking about recovery and overtraining and fatigue that you're going to be holding people back. I'm like, no, the idea is that if you look after yourself, you can do more rather than we're going to, you know, stop you from doing things.
Okay. So just again, you see, it's overtraining. So you think it's kind of bandied around, because it's funny, because I just realized how old I am now, because these things all come and go.
Yeah.
I remember it actually got to the point where when overtraining was all the rage. Remember when it was everyone was doing their salivary cortisols and things like that, and all my heart rate's up 3 beats in the morning or down 3 beats. You know, I'm overtrained. It got to the point people were saying, "Oh, athletes are getting soft," because they're all, and the coaches, everyone is so worried about overtraining that they were making sure they had all these extra recovery days and things. When you're saying, in fact, that it's actually quite hard to overtrain, and as long as you look after yourself, you can probably do more almost.
Yes. Yep. And overtraining is maybe more about under recovery than overtraining.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. So with your recovery research, why don't you tell us about that? So you said you've been looking at ice baths and various other things.
Yeah. So when I first started at the Institute of Sport, you know, Australia, we have a evidence-based culture, and there's all these athletes doing ice baths. And part of my job was to, you know, determine, should they be doing this? Is this smart? Is this not smart? So we did it, you know, probably, you know, 15 years, and we're still doing some research in water immersion, ice baths, contrast baths, timing of recovery and those kinds of things. So the focus was mainly on water immersion. We did a bit of work also on compression, in addition to obviously the sleep research, but we had a bit of a focus there for quite a few years around ice baths and contrast baths and hot baths.
So what do you find with that? Because it's a funny one, because I'm more a metabolic guy. I'm sort of, I've seen bits and pieces about how it might mess up some adaptations in the muscle and things, but at the same time, everyone's doing it. So is it, you know, and often the athletes and the coaches actually know before the scientists know.
Yes.
So what is actually going on there?
Yeah, look, it's probably the most controversial or the hottest topic, definitely in recovery, but in exercise physiology at the moment, is this ice bath and dampening adaptation. So very good consistent science. If you know, if you're looking at acute performance, so you want to back up your training or your performance, you know, if you're racing within 24 to 48 hours, a nice bath or some form of water immersion, you know, cold or contrast, is going to be helpful. Done with the right temperatures, you know, there's enough meta-analyses now and studies to show that the data is really good. So, you know, short turnaround, if your goal is, you know, within 24 to 48 hours, you want a high quality training session or you want to compete well, an ice bath will help you recover. What the question now has gone in more advanced to is, well, don't we want, you know, inflammation and damage and all these things as part of the recovery and adaptation process? And if we're doing these strategies, aren't we, you know, maybe blunting that? And so the research is very much in its early days, but from an ice bath, we don't know much about contrast, but from an ice bath perspective, it seems like the times when it may be detrimental is after resistance training, if you're looking at muscle size. Doesn't seem to have much of an influence on strength, but overall muscle size. So if you look at hypertrophy, some of the muscle protein synthesis studies, it definitely seems to do something there from a negative perspective. If you're looking at, we did a study in cyclists and giving them regular cold water immersion, they got better and better and better. But so the controversies are, we don't have a lot of good research in athletes at all, especially around the resistance training space. But what I acutely, we know it works. The question is now, if you want big, strong muscles, should you be doing ice baths regularly? And if I'm working with, if I was working with a bodybuilder, for example, I'd probably say no. I'd probably say be very conservative in your ice bath work. If I'm working with a football player, like a rugby player who's getting beat up and has to play every week, he's getting sore and fatigued over a full season, I'd be like, absolutely go for it with your ice baths. And I think that's the nuance that, you know, people don't, you know, when you read a Twitter headline of a study. So there's one that came out recently about, you know, ice baths don't do anything for, you know, it was cardiovascular something. It wasn't performance, but a stack of people that work with athletes are tweeting, see, it doesn't work. Like this was not in an athletic population. We're not looking at anything to do with athletes. So it's not black and white. I do take a conservative approach with some people because I think it's worth looking at the research that is there. But I also think that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater because there's a couple of average studies in non-athletes training, you know, twice a week.
Okay, so just to sort of summarize that, I guess, and make sure I've got it right. So you're saying in terms of weight training type strength training, it might reduce muscle hypertrophy, but not strength.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it may reduce protein synthesis after an acute bout. Yes. Yeah, which fits with that, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah, but then with endurance, so it's not reducing what mitochondrial adaptation, so increases mitochondrial volume and
and there hasn't been a lot of like those really good high level there's been a couple of those really quality mechanistic studies, but generally speaking, if you extrapolate and you just look at the performance side of things, it doesn't seem to, you know, all the cycling studies, there've been no negative effects of regular ice bath exposure.
Okay, because that's the thing. What often comes up on the podcast is you can measure these sort of you might measure the protein signaling in the muscle, and you might measure the protein synthesis over 3 hours or something, but you don't always look later on what's happened to the growth, right? But you're saying with that actually does, and they don't always fit. What I mean is sometimes you'll see the protein synthesis is reduced, but this growth is normal. But you're saying it seems quite, but you did say it probably need more research. Seems to sort of fit with strength, less protein synthesis, maybe less signaling, less of an increase in muscle size. But with the endurance, are you getting like no changes in signaling, no changes in VO2 max, no changes in 5K performance or whatever, nothing at all?
From a performance perspective.
Oh, sorry, you're getting improvements.
We see improvements. Yes, yes.
Okay, now why is that, do you know?
It's a great question. And, you know, when we look at athletes in the real world, what we hear them say is we just feel better. We're more recovered. We can do more in training. And so that's the hardest thing is, you know, if you've got athletes who are doing twice a day and they feel a little bit better and they can do a little bit more over a long period of time, that adds up. But the quality of some of the other mechanistic work yet is not quite there in terms of in some of the other studies.
That is weird, because I guess are the strength training people feeling better as well and can do more, or do they feel not as good and can't do as much?
Yeah, well, I don't know about those particular studies, but if you look at athletes in the real world, especially football players, you know, ice baths are uncomfortable, right? They're not a fun thing to do, but you keep getting, they are back in there all the time, you know, and so they're not going to do that if they don't feel like they're getting benefits from it. I would think. I don't think they've been indoctrinated to think that it's something that they absolutely have to do. But I do feel like the athletes aren't good. If they say, and I have the odd athlete that says to me, I don't think they do anything for me, ice baths. And I'm like, well, if you've tried it, well, let's find you another recovery strategy. But a lot of them will go back to ice baths. But what I do find interesting is all the research is on ice baths. But my experience in the real world is that if you could give an athlete a choice over the recovery strategy, they'd do contrast. They'd go between hot and cold and they'd keep alternating. Whether the hot makes the cold tolerable or exactly what it is, or they feel like they're getting the benefits of the blood flow and the sort of the pumping and the movement of the blood between the hot and the cold water, that might be more of what they're experiencing. But in the real world, if you've got a recovery facility that has hot and cold, athletes will do hot and cold typically.
No, is that because, I guess, can you just explain how long, how many minutes people do and how cold it is and things? Is it because you don't have to endure the cold
for
as long because you go cold and then hot?
Yes.
Or,
well, yeah, typically most athletes would try to get through a recovery session in 15 to 20 minutes. Like you should be in and out. That should be enough time. Some will do 10 to 15 minutes straight in an ice bath. Like if you've done it enough, you know, 10 to 15 minutes is tolerable in about 10 to 15 degrees Celsius water. So that's, you know, pretty simple for people to remember, 10 to 15 degrees for 10 to 15 minutes. The contrast tends to be equally about 15 minutes, starting in the cold, hot, you know, doing 1 or 2 minutes each rotation. Athletes tend to like 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, because they're not getting in and out as often, but keeping the ratios the same. You will, you know, if you ever jump from hot to cold and you hop in back in the hot after being in the cold, you'll certainly get tingling feet and hands, and you know, you certainly know the blood flow is being redistributed. You can definitely feel it. But yeah, 10 to 15 minutes for both strategies, I'd say.
And are you saying that the benefits are similar from cold versus hot and cold?
Yeah, we've done a couple of studies comparing cold and hot cold, and it seems to be both effective. Maybe the contrast, the hot cold, is a little bit better after muscle damage where you've got that inflammation and that swelling potentially, whereas we tend to target cold after, like if you're an athlete that's in a tour and you've got really high core temperatures, we don't want to put you in hot water. Like we want to just cool you down, like just cold. So you can be a little bit strategic about how you might use it. But when you think about how being in water of any form works, and you think of the hydrostatic pressure, you're going to get that regardless if it's hot or cold. You're going to have that hydrostatic pressure, which, you know, has effects on blood flow. If you're cold on its own, it might help with core temperature a little bit more. If you've got contrast, it might help with some of the damage and inflammation a little bit more.
Okay, so what is the? Do you want to just explain the hydrostatic pressure and what's that doing?
Yeah, so if you're a 6 foot tall person and you're standing in water, and you've got your head out, and so you've got water up to about your shoulders, you'll have about 150 millimeters of mercury pressure around the ankle. So if you compare that to say compression tights, which may be 15 to 20 millimeters of mercury pressure, around at the ankle, you've got a really high amount of pressure that's exerted on the periphery when you're in water. And that has a whole lot of physiological effects on blood flow, on movement of of metabolites and those kinds of things. So being in, you know, most people experience it, you hop in water, you want to go to the bathroom, there's a redistribution of fluid and flow. And so the idea is, you know, the theory is that when you're in water, it's and you've got this high hydrostatic pressure, it's good for blood flow and redistribution of fluids during the recovery period. Not a lot of research on it, but theory.
Yeah, I was just wondering. So the blood flow, you're saying higher muscle blood flow or lower muscle blood flow? Because I always thought you want to go to the toilets because the flow goes centrally, so it puts more pressure.
Yes, yeah.
So you have less flow in the muscles? Or
Yes, potentially. Although it is really early days in terms of that type of research. But we know that, like, if you're in cold water for any period of time, that the flow will certainly go centrally to protect the vital organs and protect the core. And then you get out, and especially if you go into hot water, there'll be a redistribution of flow to the periphery. So that's what maybe why we see some of those negative effects on hypertrophy, is because we've redistributed the blood flow away from the muscle.
Okay. Yeah, so it's interesting. It's making me think about, I've had a couple of earlier podcasts talking about this idea of, if you sprain your ankle, because you know how you said you have your natural responses. If you sprain your ankle, should you be taking an inflammatory? So this is more talking about anti-inflammatories and the timing of it, because, you know, it's normal to have your inflammatory process and then to adapt. And it's the same, I guess, with the cold. I'm still kind of thinking about cold. If you're because part of it, I assume, was to reduce blood flow, as you said, because you'll send it more centrally and less peripheral, so you don't get too cold. Yes. So you sort of think, hang on, you're reducing the normal responses to damage. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Saying it maybe depends on.
Yes. Yeah. And it is interesting because I've spoken to a number of physiotherapists over the years about particularly the use of icing and cooling and those kinds of things. And I think the idea that, you know, a 10 to 15 minute ice bath will reduce all of the inflammatory effects of exercise, I think that's not going to happen. Like, I think you're still going to have, and even when you ice, I think you're still going to have an inflammatory response. You know, anti-inflammatory medication may be a different kettle of fish, but in terms of water and cooling or icing, I think you're still going to see an inflammatory response. It's just going to be dampened. And maybe that's a good thing, or maybe it's not a good thing. I think the jury is a little bit out there, but you still see, you know, I work at the Australian Open every year, and you still see all the players loaded up with ice bags on their sore knees and their shoulders and their ankles. So the staff that are working with them are still prescribing it, rightly or wrongly, but it's still there.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had Christian Thorberg on, and he's a physiotherapist researcher, and he was saying the evidence for ice is not really that strong and all this sort of stuff. But it's interesting. But as you say, and we sort of touched on earlier, sometimes it's what the athletes are doing. If they're feeling it's having an effect, maybe the science might be behind.
Exactly right. Yeah.
All right. So I want to think a bit more about, I know you've done work on mental fatigue. And recovery, mental recovery, and all sorts of things. I saw you had a global practitioner assessment and management of mental fatigue and mental recovery and high performance sport, a need for evidence-based best practice guidelines. Do you want to take us through what you've been doing there and what you're thinking about there?
Yeah, so this really started through the work. We've got a postdoctoral researcher, Susie Russell, who's in our lab, and I was one of her supervisors for a PhD in the mental fatigue space, because we started to see, and, you know, Susie was working with netballers, which obviously Australians will know netball. But a lot of athletes were saying, look, I feel physically recovered and I feel like I'm okay physically, but it's towards the end of the season, I'm stressed, we've traveled a lot, and I'm mentally exhausted. So we were starting to think, well, athletes are saying this, like, how we, you know, we probably need to explore it a little bit more. So we started looking at just general, you know, questions around how mentally fatigued are you? And we'd see it would be higher around, you know, leading to competition or selection, or when, you know, there's a lot of things going on that are relevant to, for, you know, important for an athlete. And so then we started thinking about, well, okay, you know, what sort of recovery strategies should you be doing? If athletes are mentally fatigued, what sorts of recovery strategies should they be doing? And there's not a lot out there. You know, people take caffeine. If you're feeling mentally fatigued, you take caffeine. And we know that maybe that's not the best thing that you should be doing, it maybe for short term, but for your sleep, maybe not. But that practitioner survey was just, you know, Susie led that, and we just asked, you know, over 100, you know, different practitioners working in elite sport. What do they know about mental fatigue? Who looks after it? Who takes care of it? Do you induce it? How do you recover from it? Do you think it's important? And basically the summary of the paper was essentially that we think it's important, but we don't know what to do about it. We don't know how to manage. We don't know how to induce fatigue, at mental fatigue, because maybe you can train it and get better at it. But we also don't really know then, importantly, how to recover from it. So people think it's important, but they just don't know what to do.
Okay, because I saw you had, I think it was from some tweets that were sent around, you had like a table of effective mental recovery on training and effective mental recovery on competition, and you had all these sort of points and things.
So that was really around, you know, would you use, you know, would how important do you think it is for training versus for competition? And, you know, the idea is obviously you don't want people, don't want to induce mental fatigue. You want to make sure they're really recovered from it from a competition perspective. But from a training, maybe it's okay to have a little bit of mental fatigue and induce it and train it and get used to it, because maybe that will help you when you're actually exposed to it in a competition environment.
Yeah, so I remember now. I saw you give a talk, because before we started recording, I was saying, "Where did I see?" Because I know what it was now. It was Australian Catholic University, and it was just before the Melbourne Marathon, I think. And you gave a talk about inducing mental fatigue and how you do that. So I remember you were. So why don't you just tell us? I think you had a computer screen, and they had to like keep doing stuff, and tested, and then you looked at their performance.
Yeah, so there's a range of different ways that people can induce mental fatigue. And one of the classic ones is the old Stroop test. You know, give someone half an hour of a Stroop test and you will exhaust them.
What's a Stroop test again?
Stroop test is like when the word is, the word says red, but it's colored blue, you know.
That's annoying, yeah.
It's hideous. You know, it's not fun. It's cognitively challenging, right? So that's a way people induce mental fatigue, is to challenge them cognitively, to induce the fatigue and then measure different performance things. People tend to measure performance from cognitive fatigue through like a psychomotor, like a reaction time task or something like that. To look at the effects of the induced fatigue through some sort of test that involves, you know, having to use your brain.
Yeah, so I think you were doing, I know you said cognitive things, but I think you were doing that Stroop test or whatever it was, but then you were looking at their, you know, time trial and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, so that was one of the studies that we did in Canberra, but they were actually with quite good athletes, and we found that they were pretty resistant. It was interesting. We didn't see a whole lot of performance effects when the athletes were quite good. So maybe there's something either about what they do and how they train what they're doing in their training that makes them more resistant, or maybe you become a good athlete because you're more resistant to mental fatigue. We don't know, but it seems like it's a little bit more challenging it's harder to induce mental fatigue in higher level athletes.
So how does it compare? I'm just wondering, you know, when you do that sort of acute sort of mental fatigue, you know, doing that Stroop test or whatever you call it, the blue and the red, versus the person who's, you know, saying I'm feeling really, you know, mentally tired and, you know, the toddler running around and not sleeping much or something. How does that compare to then look at their performance?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's we haven't looked a lot at the chronic effects of mental fatigue, but what I think is probably going on in that situation is more around the lack of sleep that they're getting that might be inducing some of the mental fatigue. Because we know you get stressed, you don't sleep as well, and then you'll get more, you know, daytime fatigue. So it's probably, you know, we know there's acute effects, but there's probably longer term effects that may have slightly different mechanisms.
Okay, great. I think we've covered quite a bit of ground here. Just let me see if there's one here, John on Twitter. On recovery, how do you think about recovery in terms of cardiovascular system versus musculoskeletal? E.g. running. This is the one. Oh, yeah. My training app tells me I'm fully recovered. Yeah, so those apps and things. but my calves beg to differ. How do you balance the disparity between training load and mechanical load? Yeah. So I guess so, your app's looking at your sleep and things and saying, yes, you're right to go. And your calves are like, I don't want to run today.
Yes. And that's one of the real challenges of wearables is they really focus on the sleep and the cardiovascular aspects. So they're really trying to get at readiness through sleep and through heart rate and heart rate variability. So they definitely don't consider that idea of muscle damage. You know, so that's how do you integrate muscle damage into a readiness score? I don't know if you ever can, but it's certainly not done now. So that's why I always take these readiness and recovery scores with a real grain of salt. And I'm really careful about, you know, when the athletes look at them, I don't really think they're great to look at some of those scores because we've got no idea how they're calculated. We have a tiny idea, but not really. We think there's the physiological variables go in there and the sleep and the amount of exercise, but how they're weighted and how that's actually calculated, we have absolutely no idea. So I'm always like, just see how you feel. Don't pay attention too much to those scores.
Yeah. And do they, because you said they take into account your exercise, do they actually try and work out training load? You know, like, so rather than just like what your heart rate is during exercise, your heart rate times how many minutes you've exercised for and things like that?
Yeah, they'll give you, depending on which one you use, but you'll certainly get energy burn, right? So, I put quotes there, energy. So, how much energy you've expended during the day. You'll get obviously time and you'll get heart rate, depending on which one you use. But a lot of the wearable, and some of them will give you like they don't really give you a load score per se. Whoop have something kind of like that. But it's more depending on which one you use. It's more around looking at the physiological variables overnight, in particular, and incorporating those into your into the readiness score the next day.
Yep. Right. Now, Mark sent through a few questions. Should recovery / deloading be reactive, i.e., wait until you feel overtrained or have an overuse injury? Or proactive, take easy sessions and lifting less, even though you feel okay, or you do not feel the need to.
Yeah. I mean, it seems logical. Training. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Mm-hmm. No, that to me just seems like periodizing of training. You know, we know we can't exercise 7 days a week. You've got to have, you can exercise 7 days a week, but you got to have some high, you got to have some lower days, some more recovery days. So I think that just fits to that kind of model that you periodize and you have, some days that are harder than others to allow yourself some recovery so you don't get into a state of excessive fatigue.
And I guess you listen to your body. Is that still like that logical sort of old,
Is
people still say that, or do coaches sort of say, no, your body's lying to you, just keep going, or, is listening to your body still a thing? It seems like it should be.
Yeah, and I think it is because now the number of rating scales load monitoring or monitoring apps and things where you put in how do you feel and how did you sleep and how sore are you? So people are asking those questions on a daily basis. I think they're there.
Yep. All right. The other thing I know you've done is you've looked at compression garments. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we did some work, quite a bit of work looking at compression as a recovery strategy, sort of looking at it between exercise, looking at blood flow, looking at performance changes, looking at levels of compression. So essentially, the best way to sort of summarize the compression research is to say that, yes, we think it influences blood flow. It influences soreness and perception of recovery. So it's probably having an effect on, inflammation or some damage effects. There's some benefits to performance, but it's hit and miss depending on the studies and kind of how you measure it. But it's one of those things that it's probably, a relatively easy practical choice for people to use compression, and there's likely going to be no negative effects. So maybe small effects on how you feel, small effects on blood flow and soreness, and maybe performance, depending on what you're doing, but highly unlikely to have a negative influence on any aspects of recovery or performance.
So again, is this sort of like the hydrostatic pressures you're talking about within the water? So you just have a little bit of pressure.
Yes.
And it's what, increasing blood flow or
yes,
what's it doing?
Yeah. So the idea is, you know, the theory behind medical compression, which is where a lot of, you know, recovery strategies come from. They come from the medical world, you know, icing, compression, et cetera. Bring it in mm-hmm. and think it should work with athletes. But the theory is that it compresses the smaller, more peripheral vessels to force the blood through to the deeper vessels to enhance, you know, venous return and all those kinds of things. So, and there's research done to support the fact that it does that it's changing blood flow in a positive way.
Okay, and it does actually increase venous return. Has mm-hmm. that been shown?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yep.
Okay. I guess it's small. You're saying these are small.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. Small.
And this is using it during the exercise.
No, this is purely from a recovery point of view.
Oh, for the recovery.
From a recovery, yeah. Yeah, so during exercise, it's probably, you know, blood flow is probably high enough as it is, right? Mm. You're probably not going to influence it much with compression.
Well, that's what I always thought.
Mm. Yeah, but what we think maybe the some of the benefits from compression is that muscle oscillation. So, you know, if you're wearing really tight compression and you're jumping, you're probably less likely. And there's a couple of studies to show that there's... athletes call it muscle wobble, right? You're getting less muscle oscillation and muscle movement, and that maybe that relates to less damage and maybe it relates to better proprioception. And there's a couple of studies out there to support that for the work during exercise, for the benefits during exercise. The benefits post-exercise are more likely to be due to blood flow and the compressive effects and the reduction in inflammation and swelling.
I'll just tell people quickly what proprioception is. You mentioned it. Just knowing where you are in space.
In space.
Right?
That's exactly the way I describe it. Knowing where you are in space. Yeah.
All right, cool. Now, sex, I often like to think about, are there sex differences? So I guess, I don't know, across sleep, recovery, fatigue, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you had some papers on, you know, sleep and recovery education to promote female health and performance, et cetera.
Yeah, from a recovery perspective, when you're looking at things like water immersion, we've just finished one study that showed no differences in males and females. However, there has been some work done to say there is that females may experience poorer sleep over different phases of the menstrual cycle. It's very early and it may not be in all female athletes, but two take homes from it is... it's the poor sleep is probably related to symptoms, right? So obviously you've got, you know, bloating or pain or, you know, whatever you've got, then that's probably going to influence sleep. But we think, and what we hear anecdotally from athletes is that the female athletes that have menstrual cycle dysfunction, so where they've got a lot of pain or a lot of bleeding or what it may, you know, they are the ones that are also likely to have sleep issues.
Okay, that makes sense. All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. What I like to do at the end is to have a bit of a takeaway message, a bit of a mm-hmm. summation of what we've talked about, what mm-hmm. you want people to take away from this. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's great. Well, good. I should have thought about this in advance. Look, I think that to, you know, a bit of a scientific cop-out, but look at yourself as an individual and what works for you, because a lot of the recovery strategies are, as I say, early days, but there's some fundamentals and some foundations that you should not, you know, avoid. So good sleep and good nutrition, absolutely. And then if you've got those, then you can think about, you know, some of the other, you know, physical recovery strategies like, you know, water immersion, compression, etc. So the foundations are try to get your sleep mm-hmm. and your nutrition as good as possible.
Actually, one thing I meant to ask just quickly is you know how you said the compression is quite small, probably the effects, and mm-hmm. and then the cold immersion and the contrast, you know, the athletes like it, they think it works. Is part of this placebo? Because I know mm-hmm. I've thought about altitude training and talked to people about altitude training. And at one stage, someone who's a big researcher in the field said, I don't actually think it makes a lot of difference, but the athletes like it. And if it's a placebo, great, we'll take
great.
That.
Yeah.
Is there much to that, do you think? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. The challenge is from a, you know, you can't placebo for an ice bath. you know, you can't really placebo for compression because you know if you've got it or not. But what we tend to do is ask people, do they believe in it or not? And mm-hmm. we did a compression study where we found that compression benefited performance, repeat performance. So we did, it was a running cycling task, compression cycling task. They performed better in the second cycling task. But what we found was that those who believed in compression improved more than those that didn't. So we tend to ask around belief a little bit more in recovery because it's hard to placebo. But yes, I think belief is powerful and why not use it? You know, if an athlete believes in it and it's not harmful, let's go for it.
Have you done the same with the ice and the contrast? Have you asked people, do you believe in it? Or
we haven't done that yet. That would be a fun one to do.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, good no problem. And, thanks. It's great to chat.
I might see you back in Melbourne. I'll be back in a month or so. Okay.
Yeah,
see
you. Thanks, man.
It will be warmer. Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.